Hello, fellow Freedom Likers. Welcome to Legally Drunk. Jake Ubertus, Corey Pressel taking over for the next hour. You make sure the other 23 are an exercise in personal responsibility. Corey, how are you?
I am spectacular and happy to be back at it, Jake, and happy to be here with you.
All right, no Lou this week. He's busy working on a show. He had a show last week. I saw it. It was terrific. This week, I am enjoying a Canadian classic, a Molson Golden Premium.
And I've got Hazy Bones by Flying Fish Brewing Company.
So we'll let you know what we think of those at the end. Coming up on the show, we have a great show for you, as always. We'll be talking about COVID-19 and its resurgence and what that means for the American people. And of course, we have a, what I've been told, juicy was the word to describe this week's Corey's Picks, a list you can sink your teeth into. So be sure to stick around for that coming up as well. But I wanted to start the show off a little differently today. Corey, we've got two people on hold right now who really want to talk to us. So without further ado, let's go to Tom in Tokyo. Tom, what's on your mind?
And our common target is safe and secure games for everybody, for the athletes, for all the delegations, and most importantly, also for the Chinese people.
That was IOC Commissioner Thomas Bach thanking the people of Tokyo and the Chinese people for putting on a tremendously safe atmosphere. It was kind of a funny flub, I thought, maybe a little bit unfair. But the people of Japan do not want these games, and they are looking for any excuse to jump down this guy's throat. And referring to them as the Chinese people maybe is pretty much like the worst possible thing you could do, except maybe calling them the North Korean people. I don't know.
I love the Olympics, and I am excited that they are happening. I understand the sheer amount of complications that COVID-19 is bringing upon Tokyo and the games themselves. But it does bother me that he is saying that these games up to this point have been safe when, you know, just today, 63 or 60 something athletes and workers just in the Olympic Village alone have tested positive for COVID. Many of them vaccinated, or all of them, I would presume. I don't even know what the rules and regulations are there. But it's just sort of bothersome to hear him say that so in such an empty way.
As Joe Girardi would say, it's not what you want. But, I mean, those Olympic villages, as I understand, are kind of cesspools for disease to begin with. But that's neither here nor there. I do want to have a discussion on the Olympics, but perhaps we'll save that for another time. The opening ceremony is, I believe, this Friday? This Friday. Yeah. So, Corey, you and I were track athletes in college. We love the Olympics in part for that reason. It's the biggest stage for track. So we'll be excited, although I do think not just the COVID Olympics, as I'm calling it, but the Olympics in general have some problems that need to be addressed. But I don't want to keep our second caller waiting because he is, after all, our best caller. I am talking, of course, about our good buddy Don in Mar-a-Lago. Don!
By the way, you have a poll coming out. Unfortunately, I want to know what it is. They do that straw poll, right? Now, if it's bad, I say it's fake. If it's good, I say that's the most accurate poll perhaps ever taken.
You know, it's funny hearing him say that because he's not saying anything we don't know. But for him to like come out and say that, I don't know. It was a little jarring for me. I don't know what your take on it was.
He's said it so many times. I mean, I guess in part it is still jarring to hear him just outwardly say it, especially at a rally and especially hearing the entire crowd laugh and go along with it as if they're in on the joke when in reality they're the joke in many ways for following this man who says these types of things, but he says it all the time. He's admitted that he does this for 5-6 years, if not longer.
Yeah. I'd actually never heard him say that specifically, but in researching the little research I did to find that clip, yeah, he has said it multiple times throughout the years. So
he said blanketly that fake news is news that does not cast him in a great light. So I'm sort of comparing those two things. He's made many, many statements alluding to that, and I'm just sort of tying it all together. He hasn't specifically mentioned polls in sort of that way, but he has with news for sure.
Yeah. And I mean, I could do a whole analysis on that. I don't want to, you know, obviously go down the Trump rabbit hole, as we like to call it on this show, but
you don't want to talk about Donald Trump anymore 6 months after he's left office. You're not still clamoring to do that, especially after my last top five. Jake, what if I were to tell you that this week's top five is about Donald Trump also?
Well, you know what? I do tangentially have some Trump comments in my piece that I'm about to get into, but they are, in my opinion, somewhat favorable to him, believe it or not. Speaking of things that we don't want to talk about anymore, COVID-19, which in our defense, we haven't really covered that extensively on this show. So I feel like we deserve a freebie on this one. But COVID-19 has resurfaced in the United States in a major way. And I'll briefly touch on the stats, but I'm assuming most people in our audience at least have heard them already. But the Biden administration has now missed their vaccination goal that they set for July 4th. 67% of adults, or eligible adults, I should say, have received their first dose. That's 3% short of the 70% goal. And while that doesn't sound like they missed it by much, that's a significant number of people. 150 million Americans are fully vaccinated, but that's 10 million short of what the July 4th goal was. What does this mean? Well, it simply means not enough Americans, at least according to the Biden administration, are vaccinated. You might ask yourself, why is it important that beyond you and your loved ones, why does anybody else need to be vaccinated? Well, there are two main reasons. To achieve herd immunity and protect those who cannot get the vaccine, and to prevent further mutations of COVID-19. Viruses, like COVID, have a much more difficult time mutating in vaccinated people, and mutations can increase viral infectivity and lethality. We see this now with the Delta variant of COVID-19. Because the Delta variant is more infective than other strains and is now the dominant strain in the US, it's likely that the effective rate for herd immunity is beyond the 70% that it was predicted at. Combine the Delta variant with a third of adults still being unvaccinated and restrictions either being loosened or in many cases simply not being enforced, the number of daily COVID cases has tripled over the last 30 days. Luckily, we have not yet seen the same surge in deaths, but that tends to lag a bit behind the spike in cases. So I'm predicting we will see a bit of a jump in deaths, unfortunately. The CDC investigation into COVID deaths in June revealed that 99.2% of deaths were of unvaccinated people, and 99.5% of new COVID cases were unvaccinated people. COVID is quickly again becoming a top five cause of death in the United States, behind only heart attacks, cancer, car accidents, and strokes, and only narrowly being edged out by the previous two. This is really a long-winded way of stating the obvious. Getting the last few holdouts vaccinated is really important. So let's look at who's unvaccinated and how we can convince them. So, Corey, I'm about to throw a lot of numbers at you and the audience, but just try and take away the key tidbits here. 70% of the unvaccinated population is under age 50. That's compared with 44% of the vaccinated population. And I should mention that's amongst eligible people to get vaccinated. This goes down to 18-year-olds at the youngest. The majority of unvaccinated people are age 30 to 49. So there's a lot of people casting dispersions on young people for not getting it. And while young people do make up the second highest percentage of unvaccinated, that being 18 to 29, that's about 29% of the unvaccinated population compared with age 30 to 49, which makes up over 40% of the unvaccinated population. So
definitely a more sizable percentage for sure.
Yeah, it actually surprised me that it was mostly middle-aged, or I guess younger to middle-aged people were the ones not being vaccinated. But 56% of the unvaccinated population is white, 19% is Hispanic, and 14% black. 50% identify as Republicans, 30% identify as Democrats, and 20% don't identify with a party, which normally means they lean to the right in almost every circumstance. And that's backed up by the fact that over 60% of the vaccinated population identifies as Democrat. About half of the unvaccinated population has no college education. That's compared with 40% of the vaccinated population. So there's a big disparity in college education in the people who are vaccinated and unvaccinated. The income of the vaccinated population is evenly distributed, meaning people who are vaccinated in trending with the college education tend to make more money. While over 40% of the unvaccinated population makes under $40,000 a year. So that's below average. Interestingly, what I found, and this blew my mind actually, community type is almost identical. So there's not really an urban, rural, suburban divide amongst vaccinated and the unvaccinated population. The majority of people in general live in suburbs, and those are the majority for both vaccinated and unvaccinated people. On the racial divide, I wanted to point out, and I think this is a very key point here, that of the unvaccinated population, minorities have shown much more of a willingness to get vaccinated than white people have. Of those who say they will definitely not be vaccinated, 70% of that total is white. Most troublingly, in my opinion at least, the vaccinated population is 55% female compared to obviously 45% male. So that's a divide I haven't heard really brought up much by anybody, but to me that's – obviously it's troubling, but I think that's a very telling reason or statistic as to why people who aren't vaccinated haven't gotten vaccinated yet. And I'll get into that, but any takeaways you have, anything surprise you from that, what I just told spiel?
Couple of the statistics – definitely surprised me. Big disparity between Republicans and Democrats, but the Democrat number was higher, I guess, than I expected, as was the percentage of folks who make under $40,000 a year. And it's really unfortunate to think about likely the folks who do make under $40,000 a year are the ones who have jobs that are probably more front-facing or are allow themselves to be at higher risk of contracting COVID-19, which is a dangerous cycle and not something you want to hear, obviously.
I think the two biggest divides, even though I think you should keep that male-female split in mind because it's going to come into play here, but I think just factually the two biggest divides between vaccinated and unvaccinated are obviously one, political, and two, there's a sizable racial disparity as well. So I'm going to start with the political divide because I feel much more qualified to comment on that. I believe the political divide is the more relevant divide in the macro of this disease, and the racial divide can be more relevant in the micro. So earlier this week, Jake Tapper did what I thought was a great piece highlighting how the vaccination map of the United States and the electoral college map of the United States for the 2020 election, they don't just correlate. They're basically identical. So that should really, you know, highlight that there is a major political component to this. Now, Jake Tapper's conclusions and my conclusions differ. And here's why. Well, Tapper and others look to hold Republicans responsible. And undeniably, they are not without blame here. I don't believe them to be the cause of vaccine hesitancy. Now, on the surface, impoverished white men with minimal education are, as we just described in detail, the typical unvaccinated persons, and a key, or not a key, the key Republican demographic. I don't think one thing stems from the other, however. This is a group of people that just factually is heavily prone to conspiratorial thinking, something exploited by both Donald Trump and anti-vaxxers. This is a group that lives, generally speaking, via a code of toxic masculinity, something Trump exploits through his phony machismo and hollow tough talk on a daily basis. It's also something anti-vaxxers exploit through phrases like, you know, reinforcing stereotypes like, you know, real men don't go to the doctor or get vaccinated. You know, if you're strong enough, the COVID won't harm you or isn't a big deal to you. You know, things of that nature. And these are, I mean, I could just speak as a man. These are very real stereotypes and feelings held by not an insignificant number of people. So a culture has been created in a lot of communities, I think, where if you get the vaccine, you're considered soft or you're considered weak in the eyes of your peers. Perhaps most important is an overall fear of inadequacy that festers from, you know, periods of unemployment, which we've seen has been a key factor, especially as, you know, I thought Andrew Yang was kind of at the forefront as describing our modern unemployment scheme as a male problem, which I genuinely think it is. That's not to say, of course, women don't get unemployed and it's not a problem for women as well, but unemployment tends to adversely affect men a lot more than it does women. Men are really bad at finding hobbies, for example, or productive things to do. Men tend to, you know, play video games and watch pornography. It's a sad state of affairs, quite honestly. But this fear of inadequacy, I think, leads to a refusal to listen to facts, or be swayed by facts rather, refusal to listen to doctors, a tendency to, you know, dismiss liberal coastal elite education, even though a lot of Republican lawmakers like Josh Hawley, who dismissed that education, went to Stanford and went to Yale, and Ted Cruz went to Harvard. So, you know, that, I mean, that plays into one of the points I'm going to make down the road, that I think it's really just pandering. It's not the root cause here. I don't think Ted Cruz really believes his Harvard education was bullshit. But furthermore, I think people I think if they allowed themselves to be swayed by doctors or facts, they'd have to confront their own, I don't want to be blunt here, but perhaps lack of intelligence on this subject, or their own perhaps ignorance on a given topic, which, you know, is very uncomfortable to do. I think one of the hallmarks of a smart person, and Einstein, Hawking, many of the smartest people ever have said, humility is the hallmark of intelligence. I happen to try and live that as best I can. It's very hard. I'm not very good at it. But stemming from this, I think they also hate the government because they'd be admitting to the people at the top that the people at the top know better than they do. And they giving into an authority seems to be a sign of weakness in a lot of ways. And you also, in this particular instance, I think that's exacerbated by the fact that Trump lost the election. And I think a lot of people who supported Trump are not very political people, or were not very political people prior to Trump. And you have this identity, you construct this identity as being part of a movement, part of this MAGA movement, and you place so much of your own self-worth and identity into this movement, it's very difficult to accept that you lost, that you were basically in the wrong here. I mean, Trump basically said as much in a letter he wrote, I believe it was earlier, or I guess later last week rather, in that people aren't getting vaccines because they don't trust the election results and they don't trust Joe Biden, is basically what he said. And I, you know, the way he said it, I completely think was disingenuous, but I think there's a grain of truth to that as well. And, you know, Trump's daily buffoonery was, I think, music to this group's ears. He was so obviously a dope that he couldn't claim that he was better than the average man. To wrap a bow around this point, Republicans are not the cause. They're just pandering for support. They're pandering for money. They're pandering for ratings, really the same thing as money. I don't think they believe most of this, and I think a lot of Republicans at the top are vaccinated. I think Tucker Carlson is almost assuredly vaccinated. Laura Ingraham is almost assuredly vaccinated. Trump, we know for a fact, is vaccinated. And to Trump's credit, he has told people, go get vaccinated. I mean, that doesn't necessarily excuse his initial playing coy with it, or, you know, kind of downplaying the whole thing. But he has told people, go get your vaccines. He has said it. And they haven't. I mean, so to me, that's evidence right there that the Republican Party is not the cause of this. Because if they were, Trump telling people to go get vaccinated would work. And it quite simply hasn't in any meaningful way. Trump's family is also vaccinated. I should throw that out there as well. And a lot of people have had negative reactions to them posting on social media, their vaccination videos and things of that nature. This base simply is not listening. So that is my two cents on how we got there. So then it kind of begs the question, what do we do about it? Well, you know, to be honest, I'm kind of at a loss here, which saddens me, but some businesses have mandated the vaccine in order to return to work. The famed Children's Hospital St. Jude's just flat out said to their employees, get vaccinated or you're fired. They said it very plainly. However, many Republican-controlled states, which again, as I stated, are generally the states where this is the biggest problem, are preempting actions like this. That's a little bit of a term of art in state and local law, which essentially means Republicans are passing laws, or not, it doesn't have to be Republican, state governments are passing laws saying you can't do something ahead of a local, a locality or a business doing something. So many Republican-controlled state legislatures have said businesses in our state are not allowed to fire people if they're unvaccinated or mandate the vaccine to return to work. I don't know if that would survive a court challenge. I think it's rather uncharted territory, quite honestly, but I hope it would. I hope it wouldn't. Private industry and the government, I think, quite honestly, are both failing in trying to get people vaccinated, or this last swath of people vaccinated. I think private industry has the potential to succeed a little bit, but as I just mentioned, governments are stifling them. And I don't think celebrity endorsements are really helping all that much, or political leaders coming out in support of vaccines. I don't think that's helping very much. And I'm not sure FDA approval will really do that much either. A lot of people are saying when it gets FDA approval, people are going to get vaccinated. And I'm I'm skeptical and I hope I'm wrong, but I don't, the only situation I can see that helping, and I do think this will be a real thing, is when it gets FDA approval, public schools can require it. And if public schools do require it, I could see kids urging their parents into getting it and basically bugging their parents into getting it. I could see that happening. Now, whether that'll be enough, you know, I'm not sure, but ultimately, I that's my take on the political divide on the vaccine issue.
I am going to sort of, in this specific case, jump on the Biden train. And he got in some hot water last Friday with his pretty bold statements against Facebook specifically when it comes to misinformation surrounding the vaccine.
Yeah, and I'm going to let you make your point. But I will just mention, I do talk a little bit about Facebook in the racial section, but continue. This is important. Yeah.
Sure. Sure. So, you know, many people use social media. I do. I'm trying to use it less. I've stopped using certain platforms, including
Follow Facebook. Legally Drunk on Twitter.
I mean, anyone who is an adult on these platforms knows that you're essentially in one of two camps. You are on right-wing TikTok or left-wing TikTok. You are on right-wing Facebook or left-leaning Facebook. And they're sort of formed in different ways. Obviously, algorithms that these massive social media companies have created and built track what it is that you're watching, what you're spending the most time on, what you are liking, what you were commenting on, and they're going to show you more of that stuff, which creates these echo chambers where all of the information that anyone is collecting or being exposed to on these social media platforms, which is where most people spend their time, and honestly, most people get their news. You know, most people are not watching NBC Nightly News with Lester Holt. Most people, especially now, you look at the ratings of cable news networks, they are not doing well during this.
I also cut out cable news completely. I mean, you and I spoke about this. I started reading the newspaper a lot more, but I think people across the political spectrum in general are cutting down on cable news.
Absolutely. And I'm the same way. I think once the circus that was the Donald Trump White House sort of left and a little bit more, you know, regardless of your political leanings, stability came in with the Biden administration, ratings just plummeted because it was a spectacle to watch during the past 4 years. Meaning, going back to my point, a lot of people are getting their information from these social media platforms that I'm siding with Joe Biden and saying, I don't think are doing enough to regulate misinformation at all, are not putting their foot down and blocking content in ways that it needs to be done so, where these echo chambers and these cycles of misinformation continue on. I saw something really funny on Reddit. You referenced the 99.2% from the CDC, and I can't remember what media organization put it out, but the headline from one specific newspaper, or it may have been CNN, was, 99.2% of COVID deaths are from unvaccinated people, comma, Fauci says. And a person on Reddit essentially said, can anyone find me the exact same article with a different title that I can show my parents? Because obviously Anthony Fauci has become an incredibly politicized figure, which, going back to the issue of sort of Republicans and their culpability in all of this, I think it's sort of a difficult or a nuanced thing to place blame or assign blame. But the criticism of certain figures, namely Anthony Fauci, by the Republican Party over the past year and a half, has led to a tremendous amount of misinformation that I think has created the ecosystem that exists today. So I would probably put a little more blame on the Republicans than you might. I'm not saying obviously you don't put blame on them, but I think the attacking of our nation's top infectious diseases expert was really on the Republican Party.
I mean, to your point, Rick DeSantis is, I think it was a super PAC or something like that.
Ron DeSantis?
What did I say?
You said Rick. You mean the governor? Rick Scott and Ron DeSantis.
Ron DeSantis. Good catch. I think it was a super PAC or one of his political organizations just put out or started selling these "Don't Fauci My Florida" shirts. Yeah, I don't know what those are going for, but
I don't even get it.
That'll be a hot collector's item one day, I'm sure. Yeah, no, I mean, look, the Republican Party is clearly not without blame here. I think the point I was just trying to articulate, and I think you generally agree with what I was saying, is the Republican Party is – they're not the origin of why these people aren't being vaccinated.
Yes.
But, yeah, I wanted to take a second to look at the racial divide here. And obviously the question we have to be asking is why minorities are not vaccinating themselves at the same rate that white people and Asian people are, or Asian Americans and white Americans, I should say. And unequal access to vaccines was an idea that was floated out. And obviously I think there was some truth to that, at least at the beginning. I don't know if you can really make that case this far into the pandemic that unequal access exists. I'm sure there's plenty of anecdotal evidence out there, but in the aggregate, it's not really an explanation that I'm buying at this point. So there are a few more possible explanations here. You know, historical treatment of minorities by the medical industry has been something that's been talked a lot about, and I think there's something to that for sure. The Tuskegee study was a very real thing that happened. And if you're listening and don't know what the Tuskegee study is, you need to Google it. That's going to be your homework for this episode. I'm allowed one per episode. Because that is a incredibly insane thing that the government of the United States did. And you could see why African-Americans might be African-Americans specifically might be hesitant to receive a government-funded, you know, injection, with that being a very real part of our history. But
can I just interject real quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just had the opportunity, as you know, to visit a bunch of states that I had not been to on my goal of visiting all 50 U.S. states by the time I'm 30 years old. And I spent some time in Alabama and had the opportunity to visit the Legacy Museum and Memorial in Montgomery, Alabama. Incredible, incredible place. Very moving, eye-opening, horrifying in many ways. And I was with my cousin, and the two of us left the Legacy Museum and decided to walk around downtown Montgomery. And we visited the state capitol in Montgomery, Alabama, which right in front of this massive capitol are two statues, one of whom, not surprisingly, is Jefferson Davis, the you know, first president of the Confederacy. The other man was J. Marion Sims, who, for those who don't know, is considered by some to be the father of modern gynecology. And a huge piece of this man's learning and sort of forming techniques to earn this title was by experimenting on slaves and African-American women and mutilating them to find his best practices for when treating and working with white women. This is a very real thing. I encourage everyone, as you said, looking into this Tuskegee affair study. And this as well, J. Marion Sims. It's a very real thing. And I just wanted to interject because I just sort of learned about it and saw it in real life.
Yeah, I started reading up on that, when you told me about it, and I can conclude and definitively say it was not unlike what figures like Mengele would do to Jews in the concentration camps in terms of running those types of experiments. It's horrifying and a very real part of the history that, you know, you can understand why that would stick with a particular group of people. But I don't, that all being said, I think that's a real part of the hesitancy, but I think it's exacerbated by a number of other factors as well. One of the important factors I would highlight is Russian and Chinese disinformation. Through a lot of these media outlets or social media outlets like Facebook that you had just alluded to previously, we know that the African American population in the United States has been the primary target of Russian disinformation in the last two election cycles. That disinformation is aimed at othering, making African Americans feel like they're excluded, making them feel like democracy doesn't work for them, making it feel like they're not really a part of the United States. And quite frankly, I think that's a very, you know, easy thing to do. And they've obviously, as I stated, been spreading disinformation and polarization. China, their goals in spreading disinformation, I think, have been a little different. I think they've been trying to deflect the blame that they're getting for COVID-19 onto the United States and other countries around the world. Believe it or not, the vast majority of the Chinese population believes that COVID-19 originated in America. And that has been the message that they've been sending and targeting at groups like African Americans who might be more prone, for the historical reasons we just outlined, to believe something like that, that COVID-19 was created in a lab in the United States as a weapon and that it's being tested out on minorities, which is kind of similar to things that the US government has done in the past. And, you know, China's obviously just looking to deflect. I don't think there's any merit to that at all. But at the same time, you could see how this would fit into a narrative of real history that, you know, African Americans are quite all too aware of. And, you know, again, look at the Tuskegee study. But long story short, because I can't, you know, I don't feel super qualified to pontificate forever on this, but as you alluded to, Facebook, all these other social media companies need to do a much better job curtailing this disinformation. It's not all their fault by any means, but it is their responsibility. I am going to say that. And I do think, you know, I'm someone who tends to favor, as I say at the top of the show every week, an element of personal responsibility here. People need to be better. But I think it's also incumbent upon Facebook, as kind of the quote unquote adult in the room, to, even though they're a private corporation just trying to make money, curb this disinformation. Since they're not doing it, the government, it may be time for them to step in. Biden has been, and Merrick Garland, I should say rather, has been very active in, you know, filing these antitrust suits, which Lou and I have discussed at length on this show and are very, very much in favor of. But the other issue that I wanted to highlight within the racial divide was the same issue that I had spoken about on the political divide, and that's the issue of toxic masculinity. It's something that minorities are very much not immune to. And if anything, I tend to think that they are more prone to a lot of these toxic masculinity tropes, unfortunately. That stems, I think, from a lot of historical, you know, trends, you know, a lot of historical oppression that's taken place. And then the need to seem strong, the need to seem fierce, and the need to perhaps cling to traditional gender roles. And, you know, there's a reason that the African American community and Latino community in this country tends to enforce those at a higher rate, I guess, for lack of a better term. I mean, minority communities are generally liberal, but at the same time, they're also generally fairly homophobic, for example, or the African American community and Latino community, perhaps maybe for different reasons, but they tend to be two of the most homophobic groups in the country. This is a specific area where I do think community leaders could help. I don't agree at all that they can solve, you know, these problems. I mean, I know people have faulted a lot of or called into question a lot of people like LeBron James, for example, not calling for people to get vaccinated. Well, you know what? LeBron James wears a mask every time he's in public. So he does, I think, do his part to make sure people stay safe. It's kind of a slippery slope here. I know the Obamas dedicate hours and hours and hours every week to making sure people get vaccinated. It's a point where you really have to ask yourself the question, who has this responsibility? And you could say all of us, you could say none of us. I'd like to hear the argument people make for some of us. So I wanted to close this segment as I opened it up with some numbers, and that's we would need to vaccinate almost all of the unvaccinated minorities in order to hit our herd immunity goal, which I think we need to hit that number by any means. I don't care if that means vaccinating no minorities, and if there's a disparity, we have to deal with that after we reach herd immunity. I think the number one goal right now should be reaching herd immunity. And quite simply, vaccinating all the minorities who are unvaccinated is not realistic. I think almost anybody would agree with that. I think the government's focus should be on convincing white people who are unvaccinated to get vaccinated, as you only need about 10% of the unvaccinated white people currently to reach the goal of herd immunity. I think that is something that is realistic, that is feasible, and can be done, but you have to make inroads into these communities. You need to have people who clearly are the methods that we're employing now aren't working. We need to change our strategy. I don't know what the answer is, but I think the spirit I admire of the Democratic Party is that if something's broken, trying something is better than just sticking with the thing that's broken. And we're not going to know if something works or not until we try it. So switching up strategies is something I think the Biden administration should, I'm not going to say focus on, but I will say support, employ, fund, etc. So that's my spiel on COVID-19. Any thoughts?
No, I think you covered it. And I think you said it, and I will echo it. The responsibility falls on a lot of people and a lot of groups and a lot of organizations and companies. Let's just hope that the things happen that need to happen and we get to that goal where the majority of Americans are safe from this virus.
Safety first, break second, top five when we get back third. Here's Corey with the read.
Have you ever thought about starting a podcast, but were unsure about where to begin? Buzzsprout makes starting a professional-sounding podcast simple and affordable. With Buzzsprout, all it takes is some equipment you probably already have and a quiet place to begin your podcasting journey. Whether you're a complete beginner or ready to step things up a notch, Buzzsprout has a membership plan for every level of content creator. We here at Legally Drunk are one of 100,000 satisfied customers, and we use Buzzsprout because they make it easy to get your show listed on major networks and streaming services like Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Being data-oriented people ourselves, we also love their analytical approach, providing content creators with detailed statistics about their show's performance. So take it from us, the only way to create a great podcast is to start, and Buzzsprout makes getting started easy. To make their already great deals even better, they're offering Legally Drunk listeners a $20 Amazon gift card when signing up for a paid membership using the link in the description, and you help support our show at the same time. Buzzsprout, the easiest way to start a podcast. Now back to Jake.
I understand you have a list for me, so let's see if I can take this on by myself.
I do, and I think you can. I think of the long list on my phone of potential top fives that I have, this is probably an easier one. Maybe. We'll see. So, Jake, are you ready to tackle top five American political careers? Now, these are careers by individuals Okay. So that's one thing. And the way that this list was created was people holding largely political roles that they would be able to add to their resume. So who are the top five Americans who have held the most impressive political resumes in our history? And I will say one big caveat before you start, everyone on this list has been a U.S. president.
Okay, that is my question.
That is the top job. I don't love the fact that I cannot include any women on this list. There are tons of incredibly accomplished women in politics, but given that the presidency is the top job within the United States, they're all former presidents. So you've got 45 different choices. So let's see if you can get the top five.
Okay, so this is basically who has the most impressive resume.
Yes.
Okay, so I think this should be number one, but we shall see. And that, of course, is a top three president for me. I'd have to think about where he ranks, but FDR. Let's throw it FDR.
Yeah, Franklin Delano Romanowski.
Not even an honorable mention. So
what?
You really have to think not about their specific accomplishments or legacies, but more so their resumes and what different titles and roles they were able to cover and accomplish over the span of their lifetime.
A four-term president is not impressive to you. Governor of New York as well?
Oh, just wait until you see the top five resumes, Jake, because there have been a lot of presidents who have been governors and senators and everything
else.
I'll throw him on as an honorable mention because I have another president on for honorable mention for a fairly similar reason in a different way. So I'm amending my list. FDR gets an honorable mention, but he is not top five.
All right. How about to change gears here? A president who is the inspiration for the street I live on, William Howard Taft.
William Howard Taft is number four.
Okay.
Largely because he's the only president, as you know, to have served both in the presidency and on the Supreme Court. And he was also 10th Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, which I learned he only served on for 9 years, I presume because of his death in 1930. But anyway, William Howard Taft was the 27th President of the United States, the 10th Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, as I said. He was the 42nd U.S. Secretary of War, the first Provisional Governor of Cuba, the Governor General of the Philippines, a judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, and the 6th Solicitor General of the United States. Lots of different titles, all incredibly impressive. That's why he's number four.
And I don't know if you know this, was offered the job of the first Commissioner of Baseball. But
I did not know that.
He knew he was going to get this was after the Black Sox scandal that the office of the commissioner was created to, and they wanted a judge to restore the integrity of the game. Taft had also finished his presidency at that point, I believe, but he turned down the job because he knew he was going to get tapped for the Supreme Court, and it went to Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis, incredibly controversial figure in the history of baseball. So that's number four, huh?
That is number four. Good job. You got four more and some honorable mentions. But if you get the top four prior to that, I'll just tell you the honorable mentions.
Geez, so Taft is number four. That seems pretty okay. There's got to be somebody like back. One of the founding fathers has to be on this list, I would think. So
that is a fair assumption. And I will say, there's one person on this list who might not have held the most titles, but I think I included on the list because the titles held at the time and the precedents that were set in these roles were incredibly impactful. He still has an incredibly impressive resume, but that's what I'll say about that.
I'm going to throw Thomas Jefferson.
Thomas Jefferson is the founding father that I was talking about, and he is number two on my list.
Really? Okay.
Yes. So he was the third president of the United States, obviously, from 1801 to 1809. Second vice president of the United States for 4 years under John Adams. The first United States Secretary of State. That was sort of what I was alluding to in being the first, very consequential. He's also the second U.S. minister to France, and he was the second governor of Virginia. So that's Thomas Jefferson, number two.
You know, I knew all that, but I didn't throw all of that together at the same time. Yeah, he does have an impressive resume because initially you were like, I was like, really? He's above Taft? But I think that's fair. And member of the Continental Congress as well. I don't know if that's like a huge title you want to bestow upon him, but he wrote the Declaration of Independence. There's a lot there. So
absolutely. And I will say many of the founding fathers could have ended up on this list in one way or another, just given the time and given the sheer numbers of people that could hold certain roles or positions, I would say, and those who were really involved in the founding of the country.
Yeah, you know, I was debating between him and Washington, but I don't think Washington wore enough hats to be on the list. So, well, okay, so I'm missing 1, 3, and 5. There's got to be a glaringly obvious one that I'm missing. I'm trying to think more modern nowadays. And so this is going to maybe, I don't know if we're on the same wavelength with this one. I am going to throw out George H.W. Bush.
Jake?
Yeah.
George H.W. Bush is number one.
Let's go!
I have always known that he did so much prior to becoming the president, but I did not come even close to comprehending the longevity of his political career and service to the United States. It was insane when I was creating this list. So obviously I bulleted all of the titles that each of these men held. His is the longest by quite a bit. So I'll just run down the list now. 41st president of the United States, obviously for 4 years, from 1989 to 1993. He was the 43rd vice president of the United States under Ronald Reagan for 8 years, the 11th director of the CIA, the chief U.S. liaison to the People's Republic of China, the chair of the RNC, which I did not know, served as the chair of the RNC. He was the 10th U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, a member of the U.S. House of Representatives for Texas's 7th congressional district, and served in the Navy for 3 years during World War II. That is incredible.
Yeah, I didn't know he was the UN ambassador. So, I mean, I'm not surprised at all. But he had a remarkable political career, to be quite honest with you. And that really bolsters, I don't know if you remember, this was before we had you on the show, on our top five list of underrated presidents, he was Lou's number one, as a matter of fact.
I did not know that. I'm sure I listened to that episode, but I did not remember that.
That was in part, Lou admitted that was a little bit of a personal pick for him because one of the big things Bush did under his presidency was pass the Americans with Disabilities Act. Lou's father, I don't know if you know, is blind. He's also an attorney and helped write part of that legislation. So significant to him and almost every disabled person or a loved one of a disabled person as well.
Absolutely. And I think regardless of political preference or opinion, he's a man that clearly serviced our country in a tremendous way. And I think there is an amount of respect due there.
Yeah. And I would also throw in during the last few months to like 6 months of Reagan's presidency, you will never convince me it was not him running the country at that point because Reagan's Alzheimer's were pretty bad. But I will. All right. So I have 1, 2, and 4. So I'm missing 3 and 5 here. So, okay. There were a few that I was considering here. Can you give me an era for these two?
Sure. One is in the 20th century and one is in the 19th century.
Okay, so that – okay. This might be a weird one. I'm going to throw out Woodrow Wilson.
While Woodrow Wilson, after the presidency, I think it was after the presidency, served as the president of Princeton University in our home state of New Jersey, He did not make the list. Yeah, he didn't hold too many roles outside of that. I think that's one that I immediately think of beyond the presidency, but compared to everyone else, not quite up to snuff, I guess. You know, just two presidencies. Yeah. It's not enough.
Another, perhaps one that's a little outside of the box. How about Jimmy Carter?
Jimmy Carter was one I considered. Also did not make the list.
What an idiot.
But obviously served as the governor of Georgia, was the president for 4 years. He's one in my research, was one that, you know, I didn't find any direct lists, but that I was able to sort of cross-reference or pull anything from. But he was one mentioned as having a very tremendous political career, but not one I included in the top five.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking like he won a Nobel Peace Prize post-presidency and things of that nature, but okay. So...
All right, another clue.
Yeah.
Early 19th century and mid-20th century.
All right, so mid-20th century. This is one I was thinking of earlier. I don't know if this is what you went with, but I'm going to throw out Eisenhower.
No. I did not go with Eisenhower simply because the extent of his political career beyond the presidency was all military based, which was incredibly impressive. But when stacked up with others who served in the military and held other political roles, just didn't quite make it to the top of the list.
Okay. All right. So mid 20th century.
Close
so
to I already, mid. You threw out the mid guy. So close to mid.
Close to mid. Okay. So, it can't obviously be FDR. I threw out Eisenhower. I don't think Truman really did anything. I don't think Kennedy would be on the list either. Oh, so... Well, I'm trying to think what LBJ held. I know he held a few roles. LBJ?
LBJ is number five.
Okay. And
this is, of course, fifth position on the list, the weakest of the five. And I do think LBJ could have been traded out, possibly, with another person, but his list is quite extensive. He was the 36th president of the United States from 1963 upon JFK's assassination through 1969 when Richard Nixon won re-election. Won his election against Hubert Humphrey. He was the 37th vice president of the United States under JFK. He was a United States senator from Texas, and what ultimately allowed him to take the number five spot was he served two terms as a senator, which is more extensive than most other presidents have served. But beyond that, member of the U.S. House of Representatives for Texas's 10th congressional district, and he was an active member of the U.S. Navy, I believe, during World War II as well.
So he was never governor of Texas, correct?
He was not, no.
Okay.
Senator.
Yeah.
And he was known for being, I think he led his party in the Senate. I may be wrong on that, but I'm pretty sure he was a top Democratic senator from the state of Texas and had a lot of sway and power in that role as well.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm missing number three now. And you said early 19th century. It's definitely not Jackson. Who was before? I'm so bad with this era. Millard Fillmore, I think, was a governor. It has to be John Quincy Adams, because John Quincy Adams is like my number one underrated president, and he has like the most extensive like foreign affairs experience of anybody ever. So John Quincy Adams.
This is what I do.
JQA, as I like to call him, was the sixth president of the United States, the eighth U.S. Secretary of State, member of the U.S. House of Representatives for the state of Massachusetts, where he served 17 years. He was a senator from Massachusetts as well for one term, 6 years. Actually, it might have been a little less than 6 years. He was also a member of the Massachusetts Senate, so the Massachusetts State Senate. But as you alluded to, he was the U.S. minister to Russia, the U.K., Prussia, and the Netherlands And he lands number three on this list.
Yeah, like I'd mentioned, he's my number one underrated president. I liken him a little bit to Hillary Clinton, and impartially I force that analogy a little bit because, well, one, he was a very qualified candidate, and he was related to somebody who was president, his father being, of course, the second president. And I liken Andrew Jackson very much to Donald Trump. I think Jackson said the election of 1816 was rigged in the whole corrupt bargain thing. There's a lot of similarities you can make. But yeah, no, definitely agree with that pick. Run down the list for me again.
Sure. And I'll also include my honorable mentions and I'll explain those. So number one was George H.W. Bush, simply for the amount of roles he held. Number two was Thomas Jefferson as a pioneer, somebody who laid the foundation for a lot of the roles that would follow. Number three was JQA. Number four was William Howard Taft, our first and only president to serve as a Supreme Court justice. And number five was Lyndon B. Johnson. And now my honorable mentions, including FDR, who I've amended at your suggestion, I've got George Washington, of course. He would have been my number six on the list. Obviously, right. The first president of the United States, the seventh senior officer of the United States Army, commander-in-chief of the Continental Army actually during the Revolutionary War, the 14th chancellor of the College of William and Mary, delegate from Virginia to the Continental Congress, and member of the Virginia House of Burgesses. So he would have been number six on the list. And then my other two honorable mentions, I've got Teddy Roosevelt, who obviously was president. He was vice president, and I didn't know this, for months under McKinley, not even a full year, which may have actually kept him off the list just because he only served in that role for about 7 or 8 months. But beyond that, governor of New York, assistant secretary of the Navy, and beyond that, he held a lot of New York State offices and roles. And my final honorable mention, who I really only put here because of the specific, I guess, longevity of one role that he held, was Joe Biden, who was president, obviously now, served as vice president for 8 years, and was the longest serving senator to ever make it to the presidency. And he was a senator from Delaware for 36 years, which is pretty tremendous, obviously.
Yeah. I think those are some very good mentions. If there's a question of who you're taking out, I would replace LBJ with FDR, in my opinion. I just put a lot of weight to that four terms as president. It's obviously something that will never be done again because it can't be done again. But the fact that it hadn't been done prior to that, I think, is very significant. Governor of New York, too, I believe. Very successful one at that. But that's just my personal take. I have no problem with the list. I think it's a very good list, as a matter of fact. There were some excellent pulls on there in JQA and George H.W. Bush. I commend you for those two picks. So an excellent list that I think definitely lived up to the hype. Great job, my friend.
Thank you. And who would have thought that George H.W. Bush would make his way to the top of two of our top fives? There haven't been many of these top fives yet, and he has been number one on two of them. So way to go, George H.W.
Yeah, there you go. So why don't we mosey on over to the beer review? I'll just remind the audience again that I am drinking a Canadian classic Molson Golden Premium Beer.
And I've got from Flying Fish Brewing Company, Hazy Bones, which is a hazy IPA.
Okay, so this is a rather interesting beer. And on first sip, the taste was, and I'll say this without it not really being a positive or a negative, was unlike anything I'd ever had before. And it says right on the bottle, specially brewed for the unique flavor of an ale and a lager. And I think that sums it up perfectly. It's a combination of an ale and a lager. Definitely something that is fairly easy to drink despite the unique taste. I thought the taste was almost like a sour, but a light sour, if that makes sense. And And overall, I enjoyed it. It's not something I would drink a lot of, probably a one and done for me. But yeah, very inoffensive, very easy to drink. Generally what you're looking for in a beer. So yeah, no complaints overall. I like the little maple leaf on it. Nice little bottle design. Minimalistic, is as it were. And yeah, overall, pretty solid job by the Molson Golden Premium Beer.
Hazy IPA. I'm definitely impartial to IPAs for sure. This one says it's got hints of pineapple and mango, which I do taste. I taste the fruitiness. It's not super hoppy. It is 6.3%, but I tend to like the higher percentages or the DIPAs and the TRIPAs. I like it a lot. I just simply like it, and I think it lives up to its description. I would agree that it's hazy, and I would give it 2 thumbs up.
All right, all right, all right. So I will, if I had to give a rating to it, give the Molson Golden Premium Beer a solid 6, which you have remembered, according to my rating system, 5 is average, so I give it a slightly above average nod. It doesn't do anything, I think, exceptionally well, but there's nothing offensive about it either. I just happen to like the taste and like the design of the bottle, so I give it a little bit of a bump. It's an overall a very solid beer.
For me, I'd say this is something that I could have a couple of, and I also feel like would translate well to not only the summer, but I think I could be drinking this in the fall or spring, probably not the winter, but I really like it. So I'm going to land on an 8, and this is definitely something that I would drink again and would recommend.
Wow, very high praise. So very, very well done by, what was it, Hazy Flame?
Hazy Bones, Flying Hazy Fish Bones. Brewing Company.
Flying Fish Brewing Company. All right. So thank you for tuning in. Thank you, Corey. And thank me for making it all happen. Thank you for tuning
in. Yes, thank you, Jake.
All right. Until next time, we're out.